Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I'm Brian Lehrer. This is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Wednesday, December 2nd. As Joe Biden rolls out his cabinet picks, the names Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren are not among them. But Biden yesterday conspicuously name-dropped one of them as he nominated Wally Adeyemo to be his deputy Treasury Secretary.
I tell you what, Senator Warren really likes you.
Adeyemo was Warren's chief of staff. How much progressive cred should Biden get for Adeyemo, or that Senator Warren really likes him? And that's just one example of the dance taking place right now between Biden and the progressive wing, if you can call it that, if that's the right label, everybody's got their own label, of the Democratic Party as Biden rolls out his nominees. Progressive groups like Justice Democrats, which helped Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez get elected, the environment-oriented Sunrise Movement, Data for Progress, and others want someone like Bernie Sanders for Labor Secretary. Bernie himself, preferably, a position not yet announced. They want the first Native American Interior Secretary, maybe Congresswoman Deb Haaland. Do not want Democratic regulars like Rahm Emanuel, who Biden is said to be considering for a big job. And this current dance is only about the nominees. Then there will be the ones about actual policy. Joining me now for a progressive journalism and advocacy perspective of how the transition is going in these early days are Katrina VandenHeuvel, publisher and editorial director of The Nation. She's also a Washington Post columnist. And Karthik Ganapathy, a communications consultant who has been a spokesperson for progressive politicians, including Bernie Sanders, Keith Ellison, and Charles Booker, as well as the ACLU and the climate change organization 350.org. Karthik, welcome, and Katrina, welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
Katrina, in general terms, to start out, how happy are you with the emerging Biden cabinet? And feel free to name names.
Feel free. First of all, good morning, Brian. I want to just step back for a moment. We're coming out of a chaotic, crisis-ridden 4 years. We're moving toward at least restoration, though I think in these times of multiple crises, we need reconstruction. We need more than restoration. But in terms of, you know, personnel as policy, I begin, as you know, I think we must in these times begin with the more positive. I think Janet Yellen, who will be first woman Treasury Secretary, represents one of Biden's more encouraging appointments. She appears to understand we can't go back to the old ways of growth. She is someone who comes from the academy, not Wall Street. Many, you know, had hoped for Elizabeth Warren, but it's important that she doesn't come from Wall Street and have those ties. I do think the Biden, and then you have Jared Bernstein in the National Council of Economic Advisors. He's a longtime advocate for the middle class, for growth, avoiding this fetish with deficit reduction, which has afflicted, I think, Democrats for decades. Heather Boucher has been at the forefront of understanding the need for paid leave and is someone who's written for The Nation, as has Jared, and that's, I find, hopeful. I move to the foreign policy team, and I think, you know, many of your listeners understand that Biden may well be constricted. We all hope the Georgia runoffs go well, but if they don't, he's going to have to govern by, you know, executive orders, and will focus heavily on foreign policy, where presidents often have more leeway. And I have to, and I think in the foreign policy arena, I don't know if your listeners know, you know, what the blob means. It's sort of an adherence to a Washington consensus, an establishment consensus. And I think some of the names we've seen, appointments and those being talked about, you know, have been implicated in the foreign policy calamities of the last decades. Iraq, one of the great debacles of our foreign policy, the intervention in Libya, ongoing ties to Saudi Arabia, trade, fomenting of a Russian Cold War, the possibly Chinese Cold War with China. They will be returning to, quote, normalcy, which has to be understood as something critical, which is, and I know your other guest will talk about this, but the signing back onto the climate agreement is imperative. Signing back onto the Iran nuclear deal, if what's happened in the Middle East and in Iran hasn't made that much more difficult. Signing on the new START agreement, which is the last remaining pillar of arms control, signing on February 5 is the deadline or else it crumbles. So I think that's really important to understand. And the last thing about the foreign policy group is, as you know, your listeners know, Michelle Flournoy was scheduled to be the first woman defense secretary. But the progressive community has really sort of made a campaign, and I think a legitimate one, not just about her record supporting, you know, failed and tragic military surge in Afghanistan, intervention in Syria, Libya, Iraq, but also very important, Brian, the revolving door aspects of some of these foreign policy candidates. I mean, these are people who have, Flournoy was on the board of weapons contractor Booz Allen Hamilton, and they, you know, they transacted their public role for personal gain. I mean, you know, so I think that's, you know, hard said, but they come from Booz Allen, WestEC advisors, Tony Blinken. Some come from the Madeleine Albright firm, which is called Strategic Advisory, so it's opaque. You don't know. So, those are two areas where I think the economics are hopeful. I think, obviously, climate, coming out of this climate denialist administration, but Karpathy will speak to that. So I just worry that on the foreign policy, when we need such a fundamental debate at this time, a fundamental debate about, you know, security strategy for the 21st century. We've just, you know, we're living through this pandemic. And if not now, when will we understand that we need a redefinition of what security means that focuses on the existential threats, climate change, global pandemics, nuclear cyber arms race? So I think that will be something very important to look at.
Karthik, I'll bring you in on roughly the same question, but let me play a clip of Biden, another clip. If he earnestly name-checked Elizabeth Warren in announcing Wally Adeyemo for Deputy Treasury Secretary, he name-checked with a little more humor someone else in nominating his actual Treasury Secretary.
We might have to ask Lin-Manuel Miranda, who wrote the musical about the first Secretary of Treasury, Hamilton, to write another musical about the first woman Secretary of the Treasury, Yellen.
Huh. So, Karthik, how are you with Janet Yellen? Are you as supportive as Katrina is? And do you happen to know Wally Adeyemo, Elizabeth Warren's chief of staff, now nominated as Deputy Treasury Secretary, or have a comment on the way Biden used Senator Warren's name to get cred for not nominating her?
I think, to the broad question, I think in general, people like Janet Yellen, people like Ron Klain, who are going to be chief of staff, that's a lot better than Tim Geithner and Rahm Emanuel. And that's one of the things that gives me hope. This is from my perspective, better in some ways than the cabinet and the senior staff that President Obama initially put together after being elected in 2008. So that's one of the things that personally gives me hope. I do think, as Katrina points out, there's huge areas of concern on the foreign policy side. And that's not to say that these are all the people that I would have chosen. I wouldn't. But the truth is, Bernie Sanders lost the primary, and so there's obviously a consequence to that. And I think a lot of progressives do understand that Biden gets to appoint the cabinet that he wants. I think our role as progressives now is to you know, say our piece about people that we find over the line. There's reports that the Biden administration or the incoming Biden administration is considering Rahm Emanuel for some sort of top post, and that should be a clear cut, open and shut case.
Because
even if you set aside all of his neglect of the federal judiciary, his repeated advocacy for a smaller stimulus bill in 2009, even if you set that aside, then this is a guy who covered up the murder of a child in Chicago, and that should be, every Democrat should be able to agree that that's wrong.
You're talking about as mayor of Chicago with respect to a particular police shooting.
Right. And that should be, you know, a clear cut, open and shut case. But in general, Brian, I guess I would say I'm cautiously optimistic. And Katrina actually wrote a great piece about this. But the fact that Biden feels the need to name check Elizabeth Warren, as you point out, that to me is a signal that he understands the power of the progressive wing of the party, and he values the progressive perspective. The fact that he feels compelled to say that this is someone Elizabeth Warren likes, to me, is a continuation of themes that he emphasized during his campaign when he ran on, you know, Scranton versus Park Avenue. He wants to be seen as a fighter for working people. He ran as a fighter for working people. And so I think he wants the people he chooses to fill his administration to be seen that way as well.
And let's take a phone call. Craig in Westchester, you're on WNYC. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for covering this topic today and having this wonderful guest. My comment is Senators Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders shouldn't feel overlooked by not being appointed to the president's new cabinet, because Biden, I think, needs them in the Senate, where the Democratic Party will have a difficult time obtaining control. I was wondering if you guys have any opinions on that.
Karthik, as a former Bernie spokesman, do you have an opinion on that? And I'll say that several people have also tweeted that Vermont and Massachusetts have Republican governors, so the Democrats would lose that seat, and the potential to control the Senate, depending on how the Georgia special elections turn out, if they take either one out of the Senate, leaving the appointment of the replacement to the governor. So, Karthik, you want to react to any of that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the first thing I'd say is I'd obviously love to see Bernie Sanders as the labor secretary. I think that would be a huge step forward for working people.
And he is, despite who the governor of Vermont might be, he is kind of campaigning for that job. I've seen him in interviews say, yeah, he would like to be the labor secretary, basically, right?
Yeah, he stated his interest out in public, and I think Bernie's moral compass has always been sort of oriented towards helping working people. So if he thinks that this is the way he can do it, I think that makes a ton of sense. To your other point, I think there's some debate about the Republican governor of Vermont, Phil Scott, has promised to appoint an independent who would caucus with the Democrats, so someone in Bernie's mold, if uh-huh. Bernie was appointed to a cabinet position, which you can have a conversation about how much faith you can put in that. But in general, you know, the risk I think is fairly low. So I do think the Biden administration should seriously consider that. I obviously would have loved to see Elizabeth Warren be the Treasury Secretary nominee, but this is one of those things where I think we have to make our case, and I think the call is ultimately up to Joe Biden.
And half our listeners right now are going, wait, what? Vermont has a Republican governor? I didn't know that.
I know.
But that's another show.
He would appoint an independent, or he'd appoint an independent or a Democrat. But though right. Bernie is an independent, he caucuses with the Democrats, and you can't be assured of that. Though he has said very firmly he'd like to be Secretary of Labor, he could do phenomenal things, I think, with the hearings, bringing attention to labor rights and abuses.
Let's take another call. Antonio. Screeners, can I go to line two? There we go. Antonio in Bayside. You're on WNYC. Hello, Antonio.
Hi, Brian. And I'd like to say it's an honor to be on with your guests. Essentially, I'll get right to the point. The Democrats need to embrace more of the sensibility that kept the House seats for the ones that ran on, in other words, the ones that ran on more of an AOC, Green New Deal, et cetera. They kept their seats. It's a canard that's going around that the defund the police and everything hurt the Democrats, hurt the seats that they lost. Max Rose basically was running as a Republican light, and that's why he lost. He really didn't differentiate himself from Molly Atakis, and we don't need that. And another point is that the Democrats need to, you know, double down on sensibility and not labels. Raising the Social Security cap that's been at 115,000 for years, Like, that would make it solve it. Things that are common sense. Green New Deal is common sense. And stop, you know, articulating it or trying to fight back when people say, oh, it's left or it's progressive. No, it's just common sense. We, you know, there's a myriad of things that are just, you know, like Medicare for All is common sense. It's taking away from making it a profit motivation to more of a public good, like a fireman or a police department or a fire department. So I think it's just better messaging. And, you know, we can't have these hacks like Rahm Emanuel or anyone associated with the Hillary Clinton campaign. It has to be new, fresh, you know, ideas and sensibility. I'd be interested.
Antonio, thank you so much. Karthik, can you address the first thing that he brought up? Because this has been a going analysis and a going probably debate within the party, that Biden won for president, but Democrats lost 11 seats in the House and the Senate did not turn as well as expected, like with Susan Collins and some other races. We apparently saw a meaningful amount of ticket splitting with Americans voting for Biden, but they're Republican congressional candidates. And there is a lot of analysis, like the caller Antonio says, that it was a problem of leaning too far left with things like defund the police and power players like Bernie Sanders, who openly called themselves socialists, making that sweeping, you know, policy agreement that that Bernie made with Biden during the campaign. And that turned off voters in some of these more swingy districts, and that's why moderates like Max Rose lost. The caller says it was because they weren't progressive enough. The other analysis says it's because the National Democratic Party looked too progressive, and so in these moderate districts, they paid the price. What do you think?
Yeah, I'll say two things here. The first is that the thing I've never understood about this argument is that Republicans will run ads calling you a socialist, saying you want to, you know, defund the police, and they will say, they will claim all kinds of things, regardless of whether they have any basis in truth or not. That's what they did against President Obama. It's what they do to Democrats around the country. It's what they did, obviously, against Hillary Clinton. And so the notion that if we shy away from the word socialism, if we shy away from the Green New Deal, if we shy away from Medicare for All, ideas that I would add are enormously popular with the Democratic base of the party, but, you know, even more popular than most politicians. The notion that if we pretend, or if we say we're not socialist, then they won't call you a socialist. I just don't think that has any basis in fact or recorded history. So I think I think it serves Democrats well to go to where the energy of their party is, where the energy of their base is, which is in these new progressive ideas that are starting to take hold and reshape people's understanding of what's possible and have energized millions of new young people to get involved in the process.
Go ahead. You can make a second point. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll just make one other point here, which is the thing I haven't been able to stop thinking about is that in the aftermath of the election, Marco Rubio did an interview where he said the future of the Republican Party is as a multiracial working class party. That to me says we are in a moment. It's interesting to me because it to me says we are in a moment when we are shifting away from sort of a left-right understanding of politics. And as your caller just suggested, well, we're moving towards essentially a bottom-up sort of politics, right? I think the point that Marco's making is that the Republican Party needs to be a party that advocates for things that benefits most people, which they haven't done. They've been the party of corporate tax cuts and tax cuts for the rich. Policies that benefit only a very small number of people and hurt the rest of us. And so for me, the question is, can Democrats embrace this shift that's happening in our politics? Can we become the party of the working class? Can we become the party of the everyman? And start advocating for truly policies that will transform and improve people's lives without equivocation and without feeling this need to run to the center. And if we do, I think that spells enormous electoral success.
Yeah, and Katrina, to the point Karthik was just making, if you watch Fox, if you watch Tucker Carlson, for example, whatever else you may think of him, a lot of his populism rests in this argument that the wealthy elites from the coasts don't have your interests in heart. And it's a class-based argument that the Democrats need to fight, I think.
Listen, I think the reason the election was not a blowout, as it should have been for President-elect Biden, was that the campaign didn't focus enough on the economy. And I do think there is a multiracial, inclusive, class-based populism that, again, this insurgency I talked about understands you can't do, you know, identity without class. You don't pit them against each other. And by the way, many of the workers in this country are brown and black. I think the growing progressive wing of the Democratic Party is a great asset. To treat it as a liability is, you know, as Karpath was saying, is a huge mistake, first of all, because many of the issues, progressive wing's big ideas, enjoy greater support than most Democratic candidates. Look at the initiatives like the minimum wage in Florida, which passed. And I think those need, you know, and there were other tax initiatives. So I think we need also to look at, as I said, the movement people who are now running for office. The Progressive Caucus in the House is the largest caucus. It's going to be more effective as a kind of block. And, you know, it's a turning point moment, and one I think that will be accelerated by the crises we've lived through, the intersecting crises of health, racial justice, economic justice. So, you know, I think it's a mistake on the Democratic Party establishment side to dismiss the energy, as Karpath said. There's enormous energy and there's enormous support for some of these strong ideas like Green New Deal, Medicare for All. I do think, and AOC said, you know, quote, not a single member of Congress that she's aware of campaigned on socialism or defunding the police. I always felt Bernie Sanders was a New Dealer, and if he'd run in that way, he said to us in an interview once, well, I wanted to educate people about socialism. I don't think campaigns are about education often. I mean, you don't have the time. But, you know, I think we're at a turning point in this country, and it's a moment of peril and possibility. But these issues are becoming more and more popular, and a younger base is picking them up. And I think the Democratic Party risks obsolescence. And I do think what, you know, progressives are looking at is taking over the party. And I think that is a very interesting strategy.
What about the map of where the Democrats lost their congressional seats? They seem to be in these more, quote-unquote, moderate districts. So AOC can say that nobody ran on socialism from her safe seat, but that doesn't register in Staten Island, where Max Rose lost his seat, because it looks like to many voters there the Democrats were being soft on the looting that was taking place in some of the racial protests, racial justice protests, and wanting too much overhaul of the economy along Democratic socialist lines. Karthik, 30 seconds. You'll get the last
word. Yeah, sure. I think it's. It's sort of it's become a canard. I actually just don't think that this is the issue at the end of the day. I really think campaigns are about making voters feel something and making them feel like you're on their side. The notion that it's about this specific phrase about defund the police or about socialism. I also ultimately don't think that's the calculus for voters at the end of the day. Well, what it is this person on my side? Can I trust them to go to Congress and fight for me? And the way to do that is by advocating a bold progressive agenda that makes people feel like we're actually attuned to the challenges they're facing. All right. You know, low minimum wage, rising healthcare costs. Like that's the kind of stuff we should be talking to.
Katrina Vandenhoevel, publisher and editorial director of The Nation, also a Washington Post columnist, and Karthik Anapathy, communications consultant, who has been a spokesman for Bernie Sanders, Keith Ellison, Charles Booker, the ACLU, and the climate change organization 350.org. Thank you both so much. The conversation continues.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is an excerpt from my live daily radio show, The Brian Lehrer Show, on WNYC Radio, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, if you want to listen live at WNYC.org. Thanks for listening today. Talk to you next time.